began firing at once, blasting at least 30 reds out of the sky. Bazan aimed at the densest concentration of drakes and emptied her smoker, hand once again blurring on the lever and cartridges spinning away in a brass cascade. The Bloodblessed had all been trained in the same technique, meaning the reds found themselves charging into an impassable wall of bullets. The mass of drakes reared back from the fusillade, resembling a huge swarm of hornets retreating from a flaming torch.
"Reload!"
Lizanne ordered, jumping down from the boulder and slotting fresh bullets into her smoker from the bandolier about her chest. Her gaze was fixed on the southern end of the pass, the sun now risen high enough to burn off much of the mist. For a second she thought Morva had failed to pass on the order, but then saw the curved wedge of the typhoon's envelope cresting the mountainside. She rose swiftly, with the tempest close alongside, the two aerostats drifting forward as they ascended. They stalled their ascent about 800 feet above, the tempest letting loose with her thumpers, whilst the typhoon unleashed a hail of bullets from her growlers. Assailed from above and below, the swarm of reds split apart, one group banking away to the east, whilst the other furiously beat their wings to gain more height, desperate to get at the aircraft. Lizanne concentrated on the other group, watching it split apart twice more, each subdivision banking away.
"Trying to disperse our fire," she realized. "Come at us from all sides at once."
They had only a few minutes' respite before the storm descended.
"It's time!"
she called out, rising to her feet and pointing at the southern end of the pass.
"Make for the pickup point!"
Most needed no encouragement, the Bloodblessed immediately refreshing their green to sprint and leap away, with the pirates following as fast as they could. But a few stayed, mostly Verestians, but also a couple of Bloodblessed.
"Miss Blood?"
one of them asked, a middle-aged man who cast repeated nervous glances at the sky. Bazan resisted the urge to snap,
"Don't call me that,"
and forced a smile instead.
"Rear guard,"
she told him, gesturing towards the south.
"I'll be along. Now go."
She watched them flee, then turned back to gauge the progress of the White's army. The Grand Cut was thick with greens and spoiled, all the way to the promontory where she stood, the promontory which their explosives had deliberately failed to send tumbling into the pass. However, the as-yet unexploded second batch contained more than enough firepower to bring it down. Lizanne quickly spotted the detonator, positioned in a shallow crevice nearby, and started towards it, then stopped at a challenging squawk from above. Seeing a red separate from the main pack to dive towards her, she swiftly slotted a red ball into the smoker and blew it out of the sky at a distance of 50 yards. Turning back to the detonator, she rushed towards it and crouched in the shadowed confines of the crevice. Reaching into the pocket of her overalls, she extracted the item so carefully crafted by Madame Hackigan's theatrically experienced employee. Fashioned mostly from congealed glue and rubber, Bazan, with her extensive experience of disguises, had initially been skeptical of its efficacy. But, upon trying it out, she had been reassured by Takela's assertion that she looked utterly ghastly. Pressing it to her face, she took a bottle of pig's blood from her other pocket and emptied it over her head. It was thick with coagulants and possessed of a truly appalling smell, but she needed it to complete the disguise. A fresh chorus of drake screams told her she was out of time, and she reached for the detonator, one hand on the lever, whilst the other pressed the second button on the spider to flood her veins with all the remaining green. She pushed the detonator's lever, then clamped her hands over her ears, shutting her eyes tight. A bare second later, the explosives went off, Lizanne finding herself lifted clear of the mountainside by the blast. She spread her limbs to stabilize herself as she tumbled, grit-filled air whipping past as she plummeted into the pass. She didn't need to feign unconsciousness. Her attempt to slide down the flank of the dislodged promontory to the floor of the pass went well at first, but the huge slab of rock contrived to break apart upon connecting with the ground, leaving her tumbling in a cloud of dust. Something hard slammed into her back, possessed of enough force to cause serious injury, if not for the copious green in her system. Lizanne attempted to angle her feet towards the ground, intending to roll with the impact and hopefully prevent any fractures. But another something cracked against the side of her head, and she found herself falling into a vast pool of utter blackness. She came to atop a pile of corpses, blinking into the dull-eyed stare of a dead green only inches from her face. It lay across an equally dead spoiled, a woman about Lizanne's own age, with her neck twisted at an impossible angle. Looking around through bleary eyes, Lizanne saw that the bodies were all stacked against the newly created wall of rock spanning the width of the Grand Cut. Those not buried by the avalanche had evidently piled up in front of it, crushing themselves to death in the process. Lizanne tried to raise herself, which had the effect of dislodging many of the bodies, causing the pile to collapse. She rolled with the slack, lifeless forms, coming to rest on the floor of the pass, where she lay, drawing in slow, even breaths in an attempt to recover her senses. It took several minutes to get to her feet, the world seeming to tilt and spin around her. When she finally stood up, she found herself confronted by a spoiled, a tall male in a ragged protectorate uniform, regarding her with his scaled brows formed into a curious frown. She hoped he saw a fellow spoiled, albeit one with a mass of blood concealing her deformed features, not all of it pig's blood, judging by the warm trickle tracing from the back of her head. Lizanne just stared back at the spoiled for a brief interval, then staggered away in apparent confusion. She could feel his eyes on her, and could only hope he put her failure to communicate down to her head injury. The pass was full of spoiled soldiery, and some drakes, many injured and all stumbling around in a directionless stupor. Unsure of how long this helpful state of confusion might last, Lizanne kept staggering towards the northern end of the cut, her pace deliberately slow. She fell several times during the journey, not always of her own volition, as her befuddled brain saw fit to randomly deny her control of her legs. If any of the other spoiled afforded her an unduly long gaze, she would fall and remain immobile until they lost interest. The spoiled began to regain a sense of order once she came to the mouth of the pass, their confusion slipping away as they stiffened into a semblance of military bearing and began to form companies. Hoping her grievous wound would explain her immunity to this resurgence of discipline, Lizanne continued to stumble and collapse her way clear of the Grand Cut, pausing at the site of the huge camp only a few hundred yards away. Where would it be? She wondered, gaze tracking over the neat rows of tents. The answer proved obvious and unmistakable. Rising in the center of the camp was a very large winged shape, pale in the fading pool of dust. The White. She had only seen it before in Clay's shared memories, and found the experience of viewing it in the flesh both unnerving and irresistible. It's right there, well within range. The temptation to slip back into the trance was strong. Tell Takela to launch now, finish this. But she held off. It could just fly away. You came for the crystal, stick to the mission. She staggered on, joining a thin stream of wounded spoiled, making a slow progress to the camp. They were all dazed and bleeding like her, and thankfully in no condition to attempt communication. She kept to the rear of the group, head lowered as she moved in a stumbling shuffle. The fuzziness in her head finally started to fade as they entered the camp. It was mostly deserted, apart from a few spoiled, all of whom were rushing to form companies and paid the group of wounded no attention. She had expected the wounded to report to some kind of medical tent, but they all began to peel off from the group. She saw one spoiled, a
large man wearing a Corventine constable's hat and cradling an obviously broken arm, stagger into one of the tents and lay down on the bedroll within. Before moving on, she saw him close his eyes and fall asleep. One by one, the other spoiled followed suit, until she found herself alone but for two others. Lizanne began to drop back, intending to find an empty tent to hide in until they moved on. But the pair came to a sudden halt and turned to face her, eyes narrowed in suspicious scrutiny. They were both female, one with a spectacular head injury, deep enough for Lizanne to make out the white bone of her skull through the gore. The other appeared to have only a broken wrist, and was consequently much more alert. From the way their brows twitched, she realized they were attempting to communicate, and knew she had only seconds to act. There was still a great deal of green in her system, meaning she was able to close the distance in a heartbeat. The knife concealed in her wrist sheath came free in a blur, gleaming as it slashed left, then right. The two spoiled fell in unison, blood leaking from the gaping wounds in their throats. Lizanne gave a short vertical jump, bringing both boots down hard on the heads of the fallen spoiled, crushing their skulls, and hopefully preventing any alarming thoughts spreading to their comrades. She moved on swiftly, unwilling to wait for any possible reaction, and knowing her time was fast running short. The white was still ahead of her, wings spread wide and head raised. A large swirling pack of reds had begun to assemble in the sky above it, and she realized it must be summoning them back, which boded well for the fate of the Bloodblessed and the pirates. The Tempest had orders to guard the pirates until they mounted the horses tethered at the southern end of the pass and galloped off towards the south. The Bloodblessed were to be picked up and carried away at speed, thanks to the aerostat's bloodburner. The Typhoon, on the other hand, had different orders. The number of spoiled increased as she drew nearer to the white, although they all seemed to be moving towards it, meaning she managed to avoid their line of sight. However, it was clear that a more stealthy approach was now needed. Slipping into a tent, she waited for a moment to ensure she hadn't been noticed, then slit open the rear of it and moved to the next in line. It was a laborious but necessary business, eventually bringing her to the point where the line of tents ended. She cut a small slit in the tent wall and peered out at what lay beyond. The whites occupied a broad circular patch of empty ground, wings folded now as it prowled back and forth. Lizanne started in shock at the sight of a number of smaller infants scurrying about the white as it prowled. There are more! This was something no one had expected, and the knowledge banished any doubts she might have about the need for this mission. Standing at a short remove from the white were three figures. One was a spoiled of youthful appearance, wearing a Corventine general's uniform. Thanks to the green, Lizanne was able to focus on his face. His features were heavily modified by his deformity, but somehow his profile retained an echo of the earnest youth she had met in Moorsvale. Cirrus, she realized with a note of dismay, deciding T'Kayla would never know of his presence here. Not that I'll be in a position to tell her, she added, finding it strange that she was still capable of humor, even now. The second figure was also one she knew, although they had never actually met. Grand Marshal Moradin was even more imposing as a spoiled. Lizanne thought that his brutish features were actually enhanced by the spines and the scales, considering it a more accurate reflection of the soul behind the face. The third figure was odd, in that she appeared at first glance to be entirely human. A slender golden-haired woman in a muslin dress with a shawl about her shoulders. She stood at the forefront of the trio, her gaze fixed on the prowling white. When she turned, Lizanne was struck by another sense of recognition. She had definitely seen this woman somewhere, but apparently her memory hadn't ascribed enough significance to the experience to retain her name. Not human after all, she decided, noting the woman's eyes. She seemed to be in silent communication with Cirrus, from the way her gaze concentrated on him to the exclusion of Moradin. Unable to discern the content of their conversation, Lizanne turned away, searching until she found what she was looking for. A cart was positioned not far from the white, a cart in which lay four crystals. It was hard to make out the hues in the mid-morning sun, but she was certain she had found her target. Depressing the fourth button on the spider, she slipped into the trance, finding Morva waiting once more. It was clear she was close to the limits of her blue, from the way the old sailing ship pitched and yawed on a fractious, partially invisible sea.
"Are you all right?"
Morva asked.
"We don't have time,"
Lizanne told her curtly.
"Here."
She summoned one of her whirlwinds, quickly forming it into a reconstruction of the camp, then added a glowing aura around the location of the cart.
"The white's close," she said. "With any luck, we'll get it too. Launch immediately, then light the blood burner and return to the mount." "What about you? Tinkra said the blast radius." "I'm aware of the blast radius. Just get it done."
She severed the connection and exited the trance before Morva could argue further. Blinking and returning her gaze to the rent she had sliced in the side of the tent, she realized in shock that the three of them, Cirrus, Moradin, and the familiar but as yet unnamed woman, were all looking directly at her. Turning, she found the reason staring at her through the tent flap. The wounded spoiled leaked blood from the ruin of his face, which appeared to have been partially crushed. Sadly, this didn't appear to have affected his mental faculties. He glared at her in fierce animosity, a strangled growl escaping his mangled face as he crouched for a charge. Lizanne pressed a button on the spider and broke his neck with a well-placed surge of black. She quickly returned her attention to the rent in the tent wall, finding her gaze momentarily snared by the slender woman's red-black eyes as recognition finally dawned. "Famed society beauty Kathleen Dewsmine," she thought, recalling a news sheet headline, as the woman opened her mouth to scream.
"Kill her!"
She started towards Lizanne in a frantic charge, eyes alive with hatred, still screaming,
"Kill the bitch!"
Lizanne had time to catch sight of the white, whirling about with an inquisitive roar, before she tore her gaze away and fled the tent, fingers pressing hard on the spider to flood her system with red and black. Outside, a spoiled jabbed at her with a bayonet-tipped rifle, Lizanne sidestepping the blow, sending him flying with a hard shove of black. She ran as rifles cracked all around, bullets snapping the air. Thanks to the green, she was able to leap over knots of spoiled as they attempted to block her path, blasting others aside with black when they came too close.
"Launch!"
she begged in a fierce whisper, casting occasional glances at the sky as she dodged and fought. Of course, the typhoon was hovering at too great an altitude to be seen from the ground, but she did hope to catch the flare of the rocket's engine as it streaked down. The distraction nearly proved fatal. A burly spoiled tackled her, strong arms encircling her waist and bearing her to the ground. Lizanne rolled with the impact and slashed her knife across the spoiled's eyes, wrestling free of his grip, then unleashing red to incinerate the upper torso of another, leveling a rifle at her. Lizanne continued the stream of red as she ran, setting light to every tent she passed in the hope the smoke and the flames would provide enough cover and buy time. Nearing the edge of camp, she began to entertain the previously unsuspected notion that she might actually survive this mission. "It seems I wasted Madame Hackigan's time," she thought, then came to a mid-air halt as an invisible rope caught her about the neck.
"Black,"
she realized, legs kicking as she hung there.
"They have a blood blessed."
She fought back with her own black, sending a wave towards the ground to push her free, but only succeeding in spinning herself about. The hold on her neck tightened, starving her lungs of air. Bazan's vision began to dim, graying around the edges as her pulse throbbed in her temples. However, she was able to make out the sight of the woman, Kathleen Dewsmine, doyen of the society pages, pelting towards her amongst the charging horde of spoiled. How on earth did she get here? The question lost all significance when her ears became filled with a shrieking whoosh, followed by a blinding flash beyond the oncoming mob. The grip on her neck instantly disappeared, and Lizanne found herself once again tumbling in a blast wave. She used the last of her green to turn into the blast and dig her boots in the earth, sliding to a crouching halt amidst the maelstrom. Looking up, she saw the ground to her front littered with the unconscious or dead bodies of dozens of spoiled. Beyond them, a huge fireball rose from where the white had been only moments before. Lizanne's initial wave of joyful triumph plummeted into despair when she saw the beast rising through the roiling fire, flames licking at its wings but showing no obvious injury. Her sense of defeat increased as her eyes picked out something else. Four glowing orbs floated in the swirling dust above the wreckage of the cart. The crystals, she thought. It didn't work. Lizanne sank to her knees, head slumping as the product thinned in her veins. Hearing the shuffling of multiple boots, she half raised her head to see a group of spoiled moving towards her, still partially stunned by the blast, but retaining enough comprehension to aim their rifles at her. Wearily, she took a firmer grip on her knife and tried to rise, but, finding she hadn't the strength to do so, she reversed her grip on the handle and pressed it to her neck, the edge positioned precisely where it would sever the jugular. A harsh, rattling growl came from above, and she saw the upright spoiled nearest to her slammed into the ground in several different pieces. Earth fountained as the growl came again, the other spoiled falling in quick succession. Lizanne turned her gaze to the sky as a shadow fell over her, finding the broad curving shape of the typhoon some 50 yards above. It was dark against the sky, and she couldn't see the face of her rescuer in the gondola's lower hatch, though the invisible hand that reached down to pluck her from the earth was clue enough. Morva, she muttered, a vision fading away as exhaustion claimed her. I thought I told you to leave. Chapter 40. Hylemore. The fleet departed with the morning tide, witnessed by a mostly silent crowd. Parents waved and wept for the sons and daughters Hylemore was carrying away to war. Children called to fathers and siblings, but there was no cheering. In the few days since the Drake assault, Stockholm had resumed its prior state of division. The Westsiders returned to their homes, and the East Side remained under the control of the Voters' Committee, although their authority had waned considerably. Without a bloodblessed to act as a conduit for the guidance of wiser heads, Hylemore had serious doubts the status quo would continue for much longer. Cole, now sporting a bandaged nose and shorn of his contractor's duster, had become increasingly intolerant of dissent, forcing some of the committee members to resign and making most decisions without recourse to discussion. Factions were already forming around the former committee members, and there were reports of protests which quickly degenerated into brawls. Hylemore found he had to resist the compulsion to stay and provide some form of government for the city he had fought to defend, even if it amounted to little more than a military dictatorship. But he couldn't allow Stockholm to become his concern, something starkly underlined by Clay once they cleared the harbor. Who is Kathleen Dewsmine? Hylemore asked, the name meaning nothing to him. Wondered that myself, Clay admitted. They were on the walkway outside the bridge, Clay having emerged from a lengthy and apparently sobering trance with the eminent Miss Blood. According to Miss Lethbridge, she was kind of famous. Guess her fame never reached Aratia, though.
Kathleen Dewsmine is the eldest child of the wealthy Dewsmine family.
An unexpected voice said, making them turn. Akina had been engaged in cleaning the bridge house windows, and now stood regarding them with the smug air that came from possessing superior knowledge.
Despite being blood-blessed, she was exempt from corporate service,
Akina went on, in her accented but precise Mandanorian.
Upon entering managerial society, she quickly became a sensation thanks to her beauty and charm. She was romantically linked with a number of actors, musicians, and senior managers, before succumbing to an unexplained nervous condition which required an extensive period of isolation.
Akina shrugged and flicked her washcloth before adding in Verestian,
she went over the rail, and her family stuck her in a madhouse.
And how might you know this? Hylemore inquired.
Mr. Tuttleborn,
she replied, referring to the one-time bloodblessed of the viable opportunity who had met his untimely end at the Battle of the Strait.
He liked his periodicals. Kathleen Dewsmine regularly featured in one called Scandal Monthly. He had a lot of those.
Thank you, Sea Sister, Hylemore said. He gestured for her to get back to work, which she did after a typically disdainful scowl. So, he said to Clay, a mad bloodblessed is now leading the White's forces. Lead ain't really the right word. It's more like she's the means by which the White leads. Clay's expression darkened, and he let out a heavy sigh. Silverpin warned me the next one would be worse. According to Miss Lethbridge, she wasn't wrong. So if I understand the military situation, the attempt to destroy this all-important blue crystal was a failure, but the blocking of the passes into Verestia was a success. Seems about the size of it, yeah. At least they bought us time. I know the Verestian region well, and it'll take weeks for an army of any reasonable size to proceed in force along the eastern coast of the peninsula. A human army, Clay pointed out. This lot could well be different. You think we'll be able to get this whole fleet across the ocean in time for it to matter? What choice do we have? The deciding battle of this war will be fought there. We have to proceed with all the force we can bring to bear. Clay nodded, but Hylemore saw a lingering uncertainty on his face. You have an alternative suggestion? Hylemore asked. Maybe. I ain't sure yet. Let me think on it a while. Clay moved to Akina, taking the washcloth from her and tossing it into the bucket. Let's take a walk, kiddo, he said, guiding her away. What else can you tell me about Kathleen Dewsmine? The blacks flew overhead for much of the first day, descending to their shipborne perches come nightfall. There were 50 of them in all, the fleet being incapable of carrying more, not least because several captains had flatly refused to have any drakes aboard their ships, citing protests from mutinous crews. Those vessels that did carry the beasts had their holds loaded with freshly hunted Sarath meat and all the livestock Stockholm could provide. At Clay's urging, Hylemore issued stern instructions that the sailors make no attempt to communicate with the blacks. Just feed 'em and leave 'em be, Clay said. And in the name of the seer's ass, don't try and touch 'em. The sea proved uncooperative over the next few days. A heavy swell and stiff easterly winds confounded Hylemore's hopes for a swift voyage to the Green Cape, the point at the southern tip of the Barrier Isles, where the Myrdan and Erethic oceans came together. His careful organization of the fleet into two columns, the Superior leading one, and Captain O'Canus in the Endeavour leading the other, was also disrupted by the weather. Consequently, by the time they entered calmer waters, the fleet was spread out over several miles, and required half a day before the formation could be reassembled. I'd wager grandfather never had this trouble, he grumbled to himself during the evening watch, spyglass trained on the line of ships following in the Superior's wake. He turned at the sound of boots,
finding Lieutenant Talmont approaching.
Crow's Nest reports land in sight, sir, he said, saluting. An island, 30 degrees to port and 12 miles off.
So we're finally at the Isles, Palmore said. He was tempted to press on, but the Green Cape was a notoriously fractious stretch of ocean, and attempting to navigate it at night, highly inadvisable.
Signal the Endeavour, he told Talmont. 30-degree turn to port, then signal the fleet to follow. We'll anchor in the lee of the island. Make for the Cape at first light. Aye, sir.
He was woken from a dream in which a large parrot had taken it upon itself to perch on his shoulder and ask a series of unwelcome questions.
Why did Luella reject you?
It demanded, amongst other things, each question followed by a loud squawk.
Why do you pretend not to lust after Captain O'Canus?
Squawk.
Do you think they'll give you a court-martial before they hang you for mutiny?
Squawk.
Why did you let all those youngsters die in Stockholm?
Squawk. It was this last question that woke him, summoning memories that even his slumbering mind couldn't face. Curiously, however, as his eyes opened on a darkened cabin, the parrot kept squawking even louder than before.
Right, he said, reaching for his revolver, intending to shoot the bloody thing,
then stopped as he came fully awake and realized the noise wasn't coming from a parrot, but a drake. One of the sailors from the midnight watch had already begun pounding on his door by the time he opened it.
Mr. Torcreek, sir, the sailor said. He says they're all in a right state about something. Sound battle stations,
Hylemore ordered, pulling on his tunic.
Fire rockets to alert the fleet. Aye, sir.
He found Clay on the foredeck with Lutheron, the huge beast repeatedly calling out, wings spread and tail coiling in alarm. The two other drakes on the aft deck replied with equal volume, as did every other black in the fleet. A signal rocket streamed into the night sky and exploded, quickly followed by two more, although Hylemore doubted there was a soul aboard any of the surrounding ships not already awake.
What is it?
He demanded, striding towards Clay.
He smells something. I'm doubtful it's good.
Clay stared at the agitated drake in intense concentration, then let out a sharp exhalation.
Blues, he told Hylemore. How far? Close, that's all I can say. They don't judge distance the way we do. There's just near and far.
Hylemore turned towards the bridge, cupping his hands about his mouth.
Battle stations! Weigh anchor and start engines! Signal the fleet to prepare for action!
He turned back to Clay, intending to ask about the Blues' direction of attack, but the question died as the black abruptly sprinted towards the stern and launched itself into the air. From the sudden commotion on the other ships, it was clear that the other drakes were following suit. It was a two-moon night, so they could see the blacks forming into a dense flock before flying south.
They'll do what they can, Clay explained, but there's a lot heading this way. Gotta reckon on some getting past them.
You have product? Hylemore asked him.
More'n I need. Then I trust you to choose your own spot and put it to good use.
He ran to the bridge, finding Steelfine and Talmont present with Scrimshine at the helm.
Rifleman to the upper works, number one, he told Steelfine. Mining party to stand to at the stern and deploy on the turn. Guns to load with canister and fire at low elevations only. Be best if we avoided hitting our allies, don't you think?
Aye, sir.
Steelfine saluted and swiftly departed the bridge.
Mr. Talmont, go up top and take charge of the searchlight. Keep it moving until you spot a target. Sir!
Hylemore moved to the speaking tube.
Engine room.
Engine room reporting, sir,
came Chief Boswell's tinny reply.
Ahead dead slow, Chief,
and have Miss Gillette stand by the blood burner.
He waited to feel the thrum of the auxiliary engine through the deck boards before nodding at Scrimshine.
Due south, helm.
Due south, sir.
Hylemore stepped out onto the walkway to check on the rest of the fleet. They were slowly arranging themselves into a circular formation, in accordance with the plan he set out in the event of being attacked at anchor. The intention was to create an impenetrable defensive ring, whilst the superior conducted a more aggressive defense. He found the response of most of the merchantmen sluggish, compared to what he would have expected from a protectorate ship, but at least they were moving. He turned his gaze to the bow, watching the searchlight beam cut through the gloom. Lieutenant Talmont was energetic in swinging the huge light about, playing the circle of bright luminescence over the gentle swell in regular, broad arcs. Hylemore's gaze snapped to a point a few degrees to starboard, as a plume of flame erupted close to the surface. He caught a brief glimpse of two shapes entwined, one winged, the other long and snake-like. Then the flames died, and it was gone. The sound of the struggle reached them a second later, harsh shrieks of challenge and distress echoing through the sea air.
How far away are they?
Hylemore glanced over his shoulder, finding Kriz climbing the ladder to the walkway. She carried a carbine and wore her contractor's duster.
Hard to say, he replied. Mr. Torkreek sent you, I assume?
He thought you might need added protection.
Let's hope he's wrong.
They witnessed another dozen flame-illuminated contests over the course of the next few minutes, each one closer than the other. In one instance, the flames continued for some time, Hylemore recognizing Lutheron by virtue of his size as the black dragged a struggling blue from the water. The two drakes skimmed the waves as they fought, the blue casting repeated gouts of flame at Lutheron, who replied with his own, his claws latched firmly on his opponent's coils. It finally ended when Lutheron briefly released his opponent to clamp his talons onto its jaws, prising them apart to send a jet of fire directly into its throat. He let out a brief squawk of triumph before releasing the blue's body and beating his wings to push himself skyward. Watching the blue corpse roll in the waves, Hylemore realized with dismay it was at most 60 yards away.
Target 10 degrees to port!
Lieutenant Talmont called. Hylemore tracked the searchlight beam to the blue, rearing up in the white circle barely 30 yards off the port bow. The pivot gun fired immediately, the blue disappearing in a haze of red and white as the canister shot lashed the sea. Hylemore returned to the bridge house.
Ahead 2/3,
he barked into the speaking tube, before turning to Scrimshine.
Helm, hard a port!
From outside came the crackle of rifle fire, the marksman no doubt finding another target illuminated by the searchlight. The starboard cannon also opened up, Hylemore hoping they managed to do some damage. He glanced through the rear window of the bridge house, taking satisfaction from the sight of the mining party casting their devices from the stern. These were improved versions of the mines that had served them so well in Stockholm Harbor. Each had been fitted with varying amounts of ballast to ensure they lay beneath the surface at different depths. They had also been packed with twice the amount of explosive.
5 degrees to port,
he told Scrimshine, repeating the order 2 minutes later, to ensure the superior seeded her mines in a wide arc along the southern flank of the fleet. Once every mine had been deployed, he told the engine room to reverse revolutions and had Scrimshine bring the ship hard about. Even in a gentle swell, it was a tricky maneuver, taking several minutes and causing the deck to tilt at an acute angle. The first mine exploded before they completed the turn, one of the deeper ones judging by the height of the waterspout. Hylemore saw some debris churning in the mass of bubbles boiling to the surface, and hoped it was drake flesh.
Ahead 1/3,
he told the engine room, as Scrimshine brought the tiller to midships and the superior leveled out.
Port guns look lively!
Eilmore called through the window, the last word being drowned out by the near simultaneous explosion of three mines. This time there was no ambiguity about the damage inflicted. Eilmore hearing a cheer from the crew at the sight of what may have been as many as five blue corpses twisting amidst the falling spume and froth. Eilmore went out onto the walkway to watch the still twitching bodies pass by, expecting another explosion at any instant. Instead, there was silence. The struggle between blacks and blues seemed to have ended, and the Superior steamed through quiet waters.
"Scared the bastards off, eh, Skipper?"
Scrimshine asked. The answer came before Eilmore could reply. A thunderous cacophony of cannon fire from the fleet had Eilmore rushing through the bridge to the starboard walkway. He had expected to find the sea around the circle of ships wreathed in smoke, but instead saw a thick pall rising within the formation. He could hear a continuous rattle of small arms fire, as the gun crews no doubt scrambled to reload their cannon, then saw ships silhouetted against multiple gouts of flame. It appeared as if the Drakes had learned to concentrate their fire, Eilmore cursing in dismay at the sight of a freighter being entirely enveloped in flame. The fires soon found the powder stocks, and the ship's upper works disintegrated in a series of rapid explosions. Secondary blasts boomed within her hull a heartbeat later, and she broke in two, each section forming a dark V against the flames as they sank below.
"Hard a starboard!"
Eilmore shouted to Scrimshine, returning to the bridge.
"There!"
Eilmore said, pointing through the window at the gap created by the freighter's demise. He resisted the urge to order an increase in speed. They were so close to the formation that there wouldn't be sufficient time to slow their approach. It made for several agonizing minutes as the Superior closed with the fleet, Eilmore seeing another huge explosion rise above the masts.
"Reverse revolutions!"
he called into the speaking tube as the Superior's prow edged into the gap.
"Helm! Full right rudder! Miss!"
he said, nodding at Chris and drawing his revolver.
"If you would care to join me!"
She followed as he went outside, sliding down the ladder to the deck and calling for Steelfine.
"Sir!"
the Islander said, appearing at his side with the usual alacrity.
"Shift all guns and riflemen to port,"
Eilmore instructed.
"Have more mines brought up!"
He was interrupted by a hard shove that propelled him across the deck, his skin prickling at the suddenly heated air. Scrambling upright, he was confronted by the sight of Steelfine beating out flames on his sleeve, whilst a few feet beyond him, Chris stared up at the immobile form of a blue that had reared up over the rail. Its head was frozen in place, whilst the rest of its body coiled with a desperate energy, whipping the sea into a froth. It seemed as if every rifle, carbine and pistol on board fired at once, including Eilmore's, though he couldn't remember aiming. He fired until the hammer clicked. The blue's head disappeared into a red cloud as the hail of bullets struck home, tearing most of the flesh away and laying bare the skull beneath. This too was soon blasted into powder, and the blue's body immediately slackened, the beast hanging limp in Chris's grip. She released it, letting the corpse sink below the rail, and moved to help Eilmore to his feet.
"My apologies," she said. "I didn't hurt you, did I?"
"You are entirely forgiven, miss,"
Eilmore assured her. He rushed to the rail, looking out on the fleet, which now resembled something from an illustrated folio of the travail. Three ships were fully alight, with fires raging on most of the others. The sea within the confines of the circle roiled with drakes, blues repeatedly rearing up to belch flame at the surrounding vessels, then slipping below the waves to evade the subsequent mass of rifle fire. The Superior starboard cannon commenced fire, and Eilmore saw Steelfine urgently organizing the relocation of the other guns. "It won't be enough," he knew, watching the canister lash at the drakes. With most of the heavy ordnance in the fleet now silenced,
It was clear they didn't possess sufficient firepower to prevail. But there were other weapons to call on.
Miss, he said, turning to Chris. I should be grateful if you would fetch Mr. Torkreek, Lieutenant Sigarol, and Miss Gillette.
He busied himself with organizing the mines on the foredeck, having the crew remove the floats and the ballast before arming the fuses.
Captain?
Clay asked, running to his side flanked by his fellow bloodblessed.
They need to be evenly spread,
Heilmore said, pointing at the mines, then the flaming chaos beyond the starboard rail. Clay understood immediately, drinking down a full flask of black and nodding at the others to do the same. Heilmore had the foredeck cleared of crew and retreated to the bridge walkway before shouting out the order for the bloodblessed to proceed. Clay went first, lifting the closest mine and gently guiding it out and over the starboard side of the ship, then propelling it at speed into the seething mass of blues. By Heilmore's reckoning, the explosion killed at least two drakes and distracted several more. He saw a cluster of snake-like forms speeding towards the Superior. Fortunately, Lieutenant Sigarol saw it too, and dropped the next mine directly in their path. The mines flew in a steady arcing torrent after that, the sea within the circle of ships becoming a cauldron of waterspouts, tumbling drake flesh and reflected flame. The amount of explosive released so quickly in such a confined space inevitably caused the surrounding cordon to widen, making Heilmore worry the multiple shockwaves might buckle the Superior's hull plating. It continued until every mine had been thrown, the water displaced by the final explosion falling in a brief rainstorm and heralding a prolonged silence. To Heilmore, it seemed as if they must have killed every drake sent against them. The mass of dead and dying blues bobbing on the surface was so thick, he could probably have walked across it. Then he saw the snouts of more blues pushing their way up through the carnage, and knew they weren't yet done. He prepared to call out an order for Steelfine to ready the cannon, but stopped at the sight of Clay, urgently waving his arms above his head. The reason became clear a heartbeat later when Lutheron swooped out of the sky in company with a half dozen blacks. Together they plunged their talons into the gory sea, dragging an uninjured blue clear of the water. Its screams and flames of protest were cut short as the blacks bore it high and tore it to pieces, the remnants cascading over the Superior in a grisly red rain that had the crew running for cover lest the blood find their skin. More blacks followed, diving down in groups to snare a blue and carry it off to be slaughtered. The screeching and rending spectacle continued for nigh on a half hour, by which time any triumph Heilmore might have felt had faded into a guilty recognition of the cost incurred by the night's events. Several ships were still burning, and he saw another had capsized, the sea boiling around her flanks as it slowly claimed her. He couldn't hear the screams of those trapped within her hull, but they still sang in his head, loud and clear. Chapter 41. Lizanne. She had no memory of the flight from the Grand Cut, nor any recollection of the 2 days that followed. Her exhaustion was so complete that her slumber remained free of dreams, something for which she would always be grateful. On waking to find herself in Tinkerer's former clinic room, body aching in numerous places, she was confronted with a sight that forced her to conclude she was dreaming after all.
So, Arbaris said, rising from a chair at the side of her bed. He regarded her with an expression full of concern, but also not lacking in judgment. Still addicted to risk, I see.
Go away,
Lizanne groaned, pushing her head deeper into her pillow.
I've no tolerance for dreams just now.
Lizanne,
he said, tone hardening a little. She looked at him again, blinking in surprise at the fact that he was still there.
He wore the same cavalry officer's uniform he had worn throughout the revolution, though it now lacked any regimental badges or insignia of rank. His face was as blockishly handsome as ever, though he had picked up another scar. It looked to her like a saber cut, tracing along the line of his neck to his collar.
"Oh," she said, "you're really here."
"Yes, I really am." She tried to push herself into a sitting position, but her arms seemed to have been sapped of strength, and he had to help her, easing her onto the pillow he propped behind her back. He began to smooth the hair back from her forehead, but she stopped him, catching his hand and gently but firmly pushing it away. That time was past. He gave a tight smile before dragging his chair closer and sitting down.
"You've been busy, from what I hear."
"As have you, from what I hear. I take it your presence means you left the Electress in charge?"
"She finally took Merivus, showing a surprising capacity for mercy when they sued for peace. Only allowed herself one execution, some cousin of the Emperor's who wasn't particularly popular anyway. After that, the other cities in the Northern Empire fell into line. There's some localized resistance here and there, but the war is effectively over, and the Corventina Republic now a reality."
"Don't expect it to be there when you get back." Her voice rasped over the last word, and she gave a cough, finding her throat dry. Arberus poured her a cup of water, which she drank in a few gulps. "You'll be bowing to Empress Atalina the First before long."
"I won't be bowing to anyone," he said. "Though I must say the pressures of leadership seem to have mellowed her somewhat, and she has agreed to organize elections. If there's more than one candidate, I'll be very surprised."
"There will be, but I believe we have more pressing concerns at present."
"We do. I trust you brought some troops with you."
"I did, and some old friends, one of whom brought you a present."
Arshav's milk-white eyes stared up at her from the confines of the sack. His head had been severed with a single blow, which had frozen his features in an expression somewhere between surprise and disdain. His end had come some days before, and the flesh was stiffened into something that resembled dried paper.
"What did to make a deal?" Varkash said in his deep, nasal voice.
The wharf was covered in a light drizzle this morning, and a beading of moisture clung to his pyrite nose.
"An alliance between the new Corventine Republic and the Verestian League. Made the mistake of naming you his enemy. Didn't realize the esteem Miss Blood enjoys amongst those who fought the revolution. When the Electress told him to get fucked, him and his mother turned to me. When I told him to get fucked, he got angry. Challenged me."
Varkash shrugged his broad shoulders. He still wore much the same garb as he had in Skorazin, though the waistcoat he wore was fashioned from fine material and expertly tailored to fit his muscular frame.
"Overconfidence is death in a duel."
"His mother?" Lizanne asked.
"She went mad. The Electress seized her ships, gave them to me. I set the mean old bitch adrift in a rowboat."
"Lokbar hadn't lied after all," Lizanne murmured.
It had taken most of the day, and some green, to recover enough strength to come here and receive Varkash's present, so the kick she delivered to Arshav's head was weak by her usual standards. Nevertheless, it possessed enough force to propel the object over the edge of the wharf and into the waters below.
"Thank you for coming," she told Varkash, glancing beyond him to the ships moored in the sound.
There were 20 in all, armed merchantmen and the rest all former Imperial Navy frigates and sloops. Apparently, this was all that remained of the Corventine fleet. They carried a force of 10,000 volunteers, many of them expatriate Verestians, come home to fight for the heartland.
"We have much for you to do."
kind of dark in here, Clay observed, eyeing her whirlwinds, which, she realized, had taken on a much gloomier hue lately.
You have a report?
She inquired. The fatigue that still plagued her in the real world had seen fit to follow her here. This was their second trance in 3 days, and it transpired he hadn't brought good news.
4 ships sunk, he told her, after describing the blue attack the night before. Another 5 too badly damaged to attempt the crossing. We also lost a lot of sailors.
Hardly a mighty armada, she replied, but it's something. Her whirlwinds coiled in response to her frustration. It seemed their enemy had a worrying ability to anticipate their moves, which didn't bode well for the next phase of the campaign.
Moradin, she thought, forming a vortex into an image of the Marshal, alongside a slim figure in a general's uniform. And Cirrus. They both stand high in the White's Council, along with the Dewsmine woman. I assume most of its tactical acumen comes from them.
They might be dead, Clay pointed out. It was an awful big firework you hit them with.
Not big enough. The White still lives. That's all that matters.
I'm not so sure. Remember what you saw in the artisan's memories, and what Silverpin told me. It needs that woman. Needs a human mind to make it complete. Take her away, and maybe we have a chance.
How do you intend to do that? I very much doubt I, or any other blood-blessed, will be able to get as close again.
We don't have to get close, or leastways I don't.
He went on to outline his plan, which Lazan found scarcely more likely to succeed than her attempt to destroy the blue crystal.
Worth a shot, ain't it? He asked, feeling her doubt. Better than just fighting more and more battles till everyone's dead or spoiled.
She gave a grudging pulse of agreement at this, though muted somewhat by the recognition that they were fast running short of alternatives.
Will Captain Harlmore agree? She asked.
He'll take some persuading, Clay admitted, though I can tell that all the people we lost is playing on his mind, so he might be more agreeable than you think.
We'll trance at the same time tomorrow. Please ensure you impress upon the captain the lateness of the hour. Delay may be fatal.
We simply don't have the strength to defeat them in the field, Arbera said. Our best estimate is that they have over 200,000 troops, disciplined troops at that, plus the Drakes. We have less than half that number.
Lazan had convened a council of war aboard the viable Opportunity, Barkash and Arbaris on one side of the map table, with Captain Trumaine, Madame Hackigan, and Alzar Lacaris on the other. Lazan stood at the head of the table, unacknowledged but undoubtedly accepted as the ultimate authority in the room.
You forget the difference in firepower, Trumaine pointed out. With the new carbines, repeating guns, and the rockets, we enjoy a considerable advantage in weight of gunnery. Professor Lethbridge has given us another aerostat this week alone, not to mention the fact that we now have command of the sea. If our forces are properly combined and organized, it could well negate their advantage in numbers.
Superior firepower is only effective if it can be brought to bear en masse, Arbaris returned. The enemy has to be placed, or place themselves in a position where it can do most damage.
His finger traced along the eastern coast of the Verestian Peninsula.
I can see only one place where that could happen. The Jet Sands, Barkash said, peering at the map.
Arbaris nodded, his finger tracing across a short stretch of land close to a shallow bay.
The sands extend from the shore to the river, 4 miles inland. The river is too deep and fast-flowing to be forded, so they'll have to advance across the dunes, and sand makes for slow marching. We concentrate our forces on the southern fringe of the dunes, giving the appearance of a thinly held stretch of line close to shore, to tempt them to attack there. If they take the bait, we bring the fleet's guns to bear and all our land-based firepower.
Also, if they've massed for an assault, Trumaine added with a note of approval, the aerostats